Okay, have you had a tour of the building yet?
Probably yeah.
Early in the morning yet. Probably be back.
Okay.
Fantastic. Well, I love this place. It is so cool. All the light and everything. Oh, it's great. Okay. What I want to talk about today is, well, the subject of the lecture is torque 81. Okay, so quantum mechanics was a set of ideas that was developed in the early 20th century to try to make sense of our universe. And it's just sort of just as a rough introduction of why this stuff is important. Prior to the development of quantum mechanics, people had no clue how atoms work. So it turns out that there are serious problems with Newton's view of the universe, Newton's sort of picture of the universe. Okay? And it turns out that in Newton's picture of the universe, and Newton and Maxwell and all these people who came before the early 20th century, it turns out that atoms not only do not understand the detailed properties of atoms, but atoms can simply not exist in a world defined by Newton. Right? Okay, so quantum mechanics came along and, you know, like Superman, and saved the day. And atoms can actually exist in our universe. It's a pretty important thing, right? Because, well, there's an atom, and there's another one. Right? They're like all over the place, right? Tons of atoms. And if we can't explain even the very existence of atoms, then we certainly don't know very much about the universe, right? But quantum mechanics is what allowed us to explain the how things like, you know, this chair can exist. It's a very, very important theory. But it's also a very bizarre, hands down, the weirdest set of ideas that human beings have ever created to try to understand this bizarre universe that we're in. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just give you a little bit of a sense of that. So what I'm going to do is show you, okay, so you were thinking, like, primarily to theoretical physics, you're probably thinking of that this would be a theoretical lecture, right? Okay, well, I'm going to start with an experiment. Hey, this is so cool. I love experiments, man. So I'm secretly, that's my secret buddy. Hey, I can do something. So I want to show you this experiment. It's very cool. Like, it involves, like, you know, high voltage, electron beams, you know, scintillation, counter, this kind of stuff. So it's, you know, shivers up and down my spine. Okay, I want to show you this. It's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And I ordered it just for this. Like, you know, I figured I could get away, you know, with the accounting department and say, yeah, we absolutely need this for this lecture. So we got this thing. Okay, so I'll show you this thing. Okay, so from the trim line all the way up. Okay? So can you see this green globe? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so can you tell me anything about it? Is it hard to see at the back? Okay, can everyone try to see it? Okay, kind of. Alright, so here I'll hold it up a little bit. Okay, now, does it look like it's uniformly illuminated?
No.
Okay, do you see, like, what do you see?
The center is the brightest.
Center is the brightest, and then outside the center?
Fringes.
You see little rings, okay? So, that phenomenon is pure quantum magic, okay? It's the most bizarre thing happening in this universe, okay? And you might think, well, that wasn't very impressive. I thought I was dancing on this thing or something, right? But in fact, what I want to try to do is give you a little bit of a sense of wonder as to why that is so weird. What is the quantum magic going on inside there? Why is it so bizarre? Okay, so, how do we do this? So let me tell you a little bit about how that apparatus works. So what's inside that thing, first off, is something called the electron gun. Okay? So we'll just draw it like this. So it's a thing which shoots out electrons. Okay? Electrons are little charged particles. Right? Everybody knows what an electron is? Right? They're little particles. It's like a little baseball, but pretty tiny. Okay? So it says flying out like this, and there's a surface here made up of atoms. Okay? Carbon atoms. Okay? And they're lined up like a whole bunch of little soldiers. Okay? They're all lined up in some array of little. Okay, so these electrons hit this surface and they bounce off and they hit this screen here, which is the screen that you saw glowing, okay? Scintillation screen. So when an electron hits the screen somewhere, it glows green. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Okay, so suppose that, okay, so now what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna just sort of simplify to you a bit. I want to simplify even further. I want to get rid of all these atoms and replace them with just a single atom, okay, a single carbon atom. Okay, so there's my single carbon atom, and I fire electrons at this atom. Okay, and if I think of this atom as like a billiard ball, and I think of these electrons as other little billiard balls, Okay, so they're going to come in, they're going to hit this atom here, and it's coming here and bounces off in this direction, hits here, bounces off in this direction. Some of the electrons will completely miss. Okay? But you can imagine that some of these electrons will hit all these various different angles, and we will see electrons hitting the screen everywhere, and in all points on the screen. And there'll be sort of an equal probability that the electron will hit anywhere on the screen, and so the screen should be illuminated uniformly. Okay? But what we saw is, was the screen illuminated uniformly?
No.
Okay, so something different is going on. Okay. So what I appreciate first is that one thing that we sort of have to give up, or one of the first bizarre features here is the notion of probability. Okay, so in an ordinary sort of in the classical world, in the world that's at the scale of this room, with billiard balls and so on, if I had a billiard ball here and I was launching a billiard ball here. Okay, and I launched that billiard ball at some angle, you know, like 10.7 degrees or whatever, it would hit this guy and it would bounce off in some direction. Okay? And depending upon the angle here, I would be able to predict which direction it goes in, right? Okay? And so there's a sense of predictability in the macroscopic world. Okay? Well, so in other words, if I shoot that electron with some angle, it's going to hit the screen somewhere. If I shoot it with the same angle, it's going to hit the screen where? Exactly the same place. So it's repeatable. It's predictable. Okay? Well, it turns out that in this world of quantum mechanics, in this world of sort of the microscopic, the atoms here and so on, turns out that whole idea of predictability completely fails. Bang. The rug pulled out from under our feet. Okay? If we prepare the electron in exactly the same way, okay, like the billiard ball, same angle, we prepare it in as exactly the same way as nature allows us to prepare it. Okay? Then it turns out that when we fire one electron, it might hit the screen there. Okay? If we fire the electron exactly the same prepared electron, it will hit the screen over there. Completely different spot. And there's absolutely no way, physicists have found no way to understand this behavior. Found no way to actually predict in advance where any given electron will hit the screen. Okay? So there's this complete unpredictability. Okay? And if there's just one atom there, and we ran this experiment and fired one electron after another, we would have electrons hitting all over the screen, and if they were coming at a very high rate, then we would have the screen uniformly illuminated. Okay? That's what we did not see. Okay? So to get a sense of why it is not illuminated uniformly, let's add a second atom, okay? So as I said, there's actually millions of atoms here, but now we're going to have just two atoms, okay? And now we say, well, okay, if the electron, say, hits the screen over here, okay, then we know that, hey, well, maybe there are two possible ways in which the electron could hit the screen here. It could have come, say, here and hit this atom and bounced off, or it could have come here and hit this atom and bounced off and hit the screen over there, okay? Now, if I have these two atoms here, okay, then we would probably expect, okay, well, let me just ask you, would you expect, when we have one atom here, okay, then the electron can hit the screen anywhere, okay? If I put two atoms here, okay, we would probably expect that the electron can still hit the screen anywhere, okay? Okay, it could hit the screen here because it could hit this atom at this angle and bounce off, or hit this atom at this angle and bounce off, okay? It could hit the screen over here, by bouncing off the second atom here and bouncing off the first atom here. Okay? By putting two atoms in here instead of one atom, there doesn't appear to be any reason why that would prevent the electron from hitting any particular point on the screen. Am I making any sense? Okay? Is that intuitively, is that what you would imagine? Well, this bumps into the other one. Right, so if you hit this guy, bump into this one, and then go over there. Yeah, so that's actually another possibility. But it wouldn't actually, so it could like this, bounce off this one, bounce off that one, and eventually hit the screen. But there doesn't seem to be any reason in a classical world why the electron couldn't hit anywhere on the screen. Right, agreed? Okay. So now the reality is, in the real world, in our quantum universe, by putting two atoms there, suddenly it turns out there are certain places on the screen where the atoms simply cannot, where the electrons simply cannot hit. Okay, so let's draw this a little better here. So here, for example, is the place where the electron can hit. Here is the place where the electron cannot hit. Now, this is extremely bizarre, because this point over here, if I had just one atom like this, that electron would come like this, hit this, could hit this atom, and come over here and hit the screen with it. And if I had just this single atom here, the electron can come, hit this atom, and bounce off and hit the screen here. When I have both atoms present, then suddenly, for some reason, the electron can't hit here anymore. So it's a very very bizarre phenomenon. And it has to do, let me just say, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, because then, you know, you're all going to go, especially because it's really early in the morning. But I just want to say, just to give you the feel of what kind of weird phenomenon is going on. Okay? Roughly speaking, if you want to retain the idea in your mind that these electrons move on some kind of trajectory, like a baseball, moves on a path, right? It's going across the room, moves on some path, right? These electrons. We imagine in our minds that these electrons are somehow moving on some paths. To get from here to here, there's some definite path that moves on. Maybe it moves on this path, hits this line, goes there. Maybe it moves on that one and goes there. But certainly it's moving on some path, right? That's what we have in our mind, okay? If we want to retain that idea in our mind, that picture of how an electron gets from A to B, then it turns out that in order to explain this phenomenon, where you get a bright fringe here and a dark fringe here, you know, these rings, okay, if you want to explain that phenomena, it turns out that the only way to do it, the only way that physicists, struggling with this freaky stuff for like nearly a century, have figured out, these are really smart people, okay, the only way they figured it out is you have to somehow assume that that the electron is getting from, say, this point over here, okay, it could take this path here, and it could take this path here. In getting to that point, you have to assume that the electron, in some strange way, exists in both paths simultaneously. Okay? One electron, one particle, one indivisible particle, is actually, in some very strange sense, existing in a weird state that is actually both at the same time. Okay? So what that means, let me just make this a little more pointed, If I look at this region over here, okay, what's being said here is that there's some point in time, and the electron from when the electron leaves here and hits the screen here, there's some point in time where it's somewhere over here, but it's not at one definite location. It's actually here and here, you know, moving over here, simultaneously. Okay? So that's very much like saying, you know, okay, so like in the everyday world, like I'm here or I'm here. Right? But in quantum mechanics, there arises this fascinating possibility that at the atomic scale, you can have situations where I am here and I am here. Okay? So the big deal with quantum mechanics is something called superposition. This is the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics. And it is basically, or in our world that we experience here at this scale, the scale of billions of atoms, there are 10 to the 23 atoms in our body. Tons of atoms. At that scale, it's just an or world. I'm here or I'm here. At the quantum level, very tiny level, you can have situations where it's the end. Okay? That's the important thing. Okay? So I mean, there's tons more I could say about this, but is that sort of clear? You're gonna be imagining that. Clear as mud. Okay. So this idea of being out of two things happening at the same time, that's the important thing. So now I want to move on to, so right now we've just been talking about one particle, you know, it's just being in a state that's like two at the same time. I want to now move on to this possibility of now, let's introduce two particles into the picture. Okay? Then some really freaky stuff happens, and this stuff is called entanglement. Okay? So let's start with this. Let's start with a coin toss, okay? So I take a coin, I toss it, and I would actually do it, but I'm really bad at tossing coins. I'll be dropping all over the floor, I'll be running like underneath the scenes and everything, so I'll just have to imagine like the coin toss, okay? So flip the coin, it goes up, it comes back down, so like this. And then what I do is I take the coin and I cut it along its face like this. So I end up with two faces, a head face and a tail face, okay? I cut it in half that way, two circles. I never know how to say that. Does that make sense? Or, I don't know, whatever case. So I have two faces. Okay, and I take these two things, and I, without looking at them, with my eyes closed, and I put them inside two boxes, and I seal the boxes. Okay, then I open my eyes, and I give one box to Alice, and one box to Bob. Okay, Bob stays here on the Earth, and Alice goes on her little adventure to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star. Okay, and so here's our situation. So here's the two boxes. They start out like this, and there's and we flip the coin, we cut the coin in half, we put a half coin there, okay, and then we've taken these boxes and we've separated them by a very great distance. So you know, here we've got like, you know, Bob on the Earth, and he's got this box here. And actually let's put Bob over here. So Bob's over here on the Earth, and Alice is over here. So all of these names come from Alice in Wonderland, right? That kind of thing. Alice always gets a fun experiences, and Bob is just Bob. Yeah. Bob is he just didn't usually get the kind of fun stuff happening. Okay, so we'll have Alice. Okay, so let's see. So what happens here? So here is Alice, and Alice opens up her box, and what does she find inside? Half point. What is it? How do you know I'm lucky? Right? Could be whatever, right? Give it a chance. You open the box. Hey, look, I got a head in there. So I know that must be manly. Bob opens his box and looks inside, he will see a tail inside there. Okay? And of course, there's a possibility of tail and head. So there's nothing surprising here, no babies, okay? It's all obvious, okay? There's two possibilities in the sort of everyday world, in the macroscopic world. Okay, heads, tails, or tails, heads. Okay. Now, in quantum mechanics, in our real quantum universe, it is possible to have this thing, not an or, but an and. Okay. So now what I'm talking about is not half coins anymore. I'm talking about particles, like electrons. Electrons can be, they have certain properties. Right? It doesn't matter what they're called. For example, if one of them is called spin, okay, so the electron can be spinning up or it can be spinning down. That's like heads, tails, like on, off. It's like a two-state thing. Okay? So we have two electrons, okay, which represent sort of the two half points, and they can be sort of up, down, all that other stuff. Okay? So now it turns out that you can prepare this pair of electrons or this pair of photons, particles of light, you can prepare these small microscopic particles in states such that they are in a superposition, in this sort of combination of heads, tails, not or, but and. Okay? So what does that mean? Okay. So we close the boxes here. Okay? And what's inside here? In sort of the macroscopic picture, in like the coin toss thing, it was pretty clear that before we separated these boxes, there was a definite either a head there and a tail there or the opposite, right? And then we just separated them to a great distance and they looked and it was no big surprise. Okay? But now with these particles, what's happening is inside Alice's box, before she opens it, inside Alice's box is neither a head nor a tail. Okay? Because the whole system is in some kind of superposition. Simultaneously, this possibility, heads, tails, and this possibility, tails, heads. Okay? So what's inside her box is neither a definite head or a tail. Okay? It's something sort of in between. And in fact, what's so sort of a, we'll just indicate that by some kind of question mark. And in fact, what's really interesting about this is that so what's inside the box can't be described by just looking by just sort of paying attention to that box. It's an isolated system. Okay. So in other words, in order to describe, you can't even mathematically or any other way describe what is inside that box without also talking about what is inside Bob's box. Okay. So it's a little bit like, and when quantum mechanics was first developed, a lot of the early forefathers of quantum mechanics, several of them drew attention to similarities with sort of Eastern religions, or Eastern mysticism compared to Western ideas. So Western ideas tend to focus on, hey, I've got this world, and I can break this world up into smaller, here's my big world, And I can break my world up into smaller pieces. And I can look at that piece all by itself and talk about that piece all by itself. Analyze it, you know, poke it and prod it and heat it up with, you know, Bunsen burners or something. I can do stuff like that to it, right? But the more Eastern kind of feel is, well, no, you can't really do that. This thing is sort of connected to this thing over here. And you can't really isolate that. Okay? So it has that feel. You can't talk about what's inside this box just by itself. You have to broaden your view and you have to treat this entire thing as one system. Even though this is on the Earth and this is on Alpha Centauri, we're some zillions of light years away. Okay? They started out together as one system, but because they're entangled, that's the word here, you can pull them apart to any distance and they still behave in certain ways like one system. Okay? So anyway, so now let me just say, so what happens when Alice and Bob make some observations here? Okay, so what's inside this box is a question mark. Okay? It's an indefinite state, I'll call it. Okay? Alice looks inside the box. Okay? The act of Alice opening the box and looking at the thing, what it does is it induces that state from it starts out as this indefinite, ghostly type thing, and it becomes definite. It's definitely a head or a tail. Okay? So suddenly it becomes, so what it does is it forces nature, there's two possibilities here. Nature is inside of this. You know, it's a combination of these two, sort of simultaneously. When Alice looks in the box, she forces nature to make a choice. To definitely make up your mind, okay? And nature makes up her mind, and she uses either this or this, purely randomly, okay? And so suppose that nature chose this, okay? Well, that means that what happens inside Alice's box is suddenly that becomes a head. What do you think happens in Bob's box? It has to be a tail, okay? And so what has happened is, this is a very subtle point here, what has happened is, even though Bob hasn't looked inside his box yet, okay? What has happened is, the contents of this box has changed, okay? It used to be something which was an indefinite, this sort of, I don't like to use the word ghostly, but that kind of thing, okay? An indefinite state, and it instantly, at the instant Alice looks inside her box, even though this is 3 billion miles away, this thing changed to a tail. It changed from an indefinite state to a definite state. Okay? Then Bob looks inside his box to see the tail every next time. Okay? So what I want to say is something here is spooky. Okay? And the spookiness is this. It's like something that Alice has done over here, and maybe she looks inside her box, she's sitting on Alpha Centauri. Okay? Like fancy Bob, he's nowhere near, okay? And if she opens up her box and whatever, okay? But at the same instant, even though Bob might be on the opposite side of the galaxy, something has happened to Bob's box. Now, what did Albert Einstein tell us about speed of light and all that stuff? It's finite. Nothing can travel at faster than speed of light. Okay. Well, it appears as if something is happening, some influence, something is happening faster than the speed of light. Okay. Now, it turns out, and I don't want to get into this because we don't have time in this lecture, but it turns out that you can't actually use this property, this faster than light property. Whatever is happening, or whatever appears to be happening, whatever may be happening at a faster than light speed, you can't actually use that to send useful information. Okay? There's just, I can't get into that, but it's a fascinating, it's an entirely fascinating topic. But the point is, so it doesn't actually violate sort of the letter of the law, because I can't actually send useful information, okay, faster than the speed of light. But it does certainly violate the spirit of relativity. Okay? So this is a huge issue, okay, and it's completely unresolved. It's completely wide open, what's actually going on here. Okay? And that's what researchers at Primary Institute, that's one of the things they do, is called Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. They try to understand the nature of reality, what's actually going on in these boxes. And the usefulness for this is all kinds of things, quantum computers and all kinds of other applications and stuff, which I don't really have time to discuss. So let me just move on to actually the next little story. Okay, so I wanted to switch to PowerPoint. So I'm going to try to leave some time for questions at the end. We're going until 12:15, right? So we've got half an hour. Okay, so that's good. So let me turn this slide on.
things that are going on here. John. That's not on. There we go.
Physicists absolutely love blackboards, so, and, you know, PowerPoint is a real, like, you know, yeah, whatever. Okay, so here we go. So let's introduce here, so this is Alice, okay? Alice is the hero of our story. You know, Alice is actually a pretty high-power theoretical physicist. So, of course, she works at Perimeter Institute. And the main her main work, of course, is she's sitting on the couch here, you know, reading and thinking and deeply contemplating deeply. Okay, that's what we do here. Okay? Actually, it's not all sitting on couches, I can assure you. She's standing on top floors and everything. Okay. But so not only is she a theoretical physicist, she also happens to be, this is a very rare combination, also a very experimental physicist. Okay, so now I got this off the web. Clearly this doesn't look anything like Alice. And Alice does not have beakers and stuff like that. You know, it's more physics-y kind of stuff, not chemistry. But you know, what can you do? This is the best I can. So it's theory and experiment. Okay, and what she's going to want to build something called a quantum teleportation device. Okay, I should say here, this guy here is Schrödinger's cat. Okay, does anyone know anything about Schrödinger's cat? A little bit?
Okay. No idea.
I don't worry about that. But all I'll tell you is that she treats Schrödinger's cat much better than Schrödinger did. Okay. So now here's the thing. Alice lives here on the Earth. Okay? And she's, but she's got this guy that she hasn't actually met, okay, but then he's up on Mars here, okay? He's working on some, you know, some whatever, you know, plantation thing up there on Mars. Station. Thank you. Okay, that's what he's doing up there. Okay. And she's met this guy through interplanetary internet dating. Okay? Now you see these people here, they've got, there's Alice there, and they've got these sunglasses on. So and what does that represent? That represents that with this internet dating, you can't ever be quite sure what you're getting, right? So what she wants to do is, she wants to go up to Mars and actually meet the guy in person. Okay? Because who knows? You know, when I found this on the internet, I was looking, I typed in the word dork. That's what came up, okay? So, what he's been advertised for, what he's been advertising himself as, is this guy, okay? And so, you know, some whatever cool, like, rock star kind of guy, okay? So, anyway, so what she wants to do is get there. Now, she's got a couple of choices. One choice is she can like get into a spaceship, which is a great big tin can, and sit there for like 6 months on a journey over Mars, right? And hope that she gets there. And the other possibility is she's pretty anxious to get there. The other possibility is she can build a quantum teleportation device. Okay, so she's going to use her great skills as a theoretician and an experimentalist to do this. Right? So at the end of the day, it's going to end up happy and they're going to be like grooving up there on Mars. Okay, so that's the plan. So now we need to figure out what is teleportation. Okay? So when I say teleportation, what comes to mind? Distance. So we're trying to move something over distance. Okay, and what else?
Space. You need like spinning material laws, it's electronic.
Yeah, that's good. So somehow we're gonna involve electronic kind of technology in this whole process. Okay. So those are good ideas, and it brings up this whole idea of Star Trek kind of teleportation. The difference here is it isn't stuff we're making up. The difference here is that it's actually what may be possible in our physical universe. So what is teleportation? We're going to have Alice up here. She's in her little lotus position, her thinking position. She's going to help us figure this whole thing out. Okay, so first off, here's Alice, and this is a cold wintry day here. And so teleportation means she would disappear here somehow, some means, and she would reappear somewhere over there in some, you know, nicer climate or whatever, right? Now notice that there was some time delay between there and there. Okay, so we would expect that whatever teleportation machine we build, it's going to involve a time delay. We can't send actual physical stuff faster than the speed of light, so we can't bind out that. Okay, so there's going to be a time delay. Okay, something less than speed of light. Right. Now the second thing, okay, so let's try to see how we might do this. So here we've got Alice wanting to get to Mars. And so one way that we could teleport her is we could disassemble her into individual atoms. So a great big heap of atoms, take all the, you know, 10 to the 23 atoms in her body, you know, take them all apart into one big heap, and send those atoms, beam those atoms over to Mars, and then reassemble all those atoms like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. Okay? I know, it's kind of cheesy graphics, and this is the best I can do with PowerPoint, okay? So what's required there? So we're sending atoms over, but when we get on this side over here, what do we need besides the atoms? To reconstruct her, information. So we need to figure out how all of our atoms, you know, like this hip bone is connected to the knee bone. We need to figure out how all those atoms are connected to each other and how they're organized and everything, okay? That's a heck of a lot of information. So we need to somehow measure that information and send that information along with all those atoms so that our, like, master puzzle maker can jigsaw puzzle person can, like, put her back together. Okay, the Humpty Dumpty thing. Does anyone know who Humpty Dumpty is? And then you fell, and then you put it back together.
And I got forced to do it.
Forced to do it? That's weird. That is weird. I know. Okay. So here's the thing. The fact is that this whole process is unnecessarily complicated. Okay, so quantum mechanics comes to the rescue, and it says that. So this is our little quantum fact. Our fact is that all atoms in the universe of the same type, no matter where they are in the universe, are truly identical. Okay, so I'm Alice here, and I've got, I take this little calcium atom out of my hip, you know, thick, and I pull one out of a glass of milk and stick it in there. It's still Alice, right? It's still really Alice. Okay, that calcium atom that I just picked away is identical to the calcium atom in that glass of milk. Okay, so when you come down to, like objects, I have two baseballs manufactured exactly identically, and so when I look at them and I say, yeah, they look pretty much the same, and I know they look identical, but as I look at the microscope, and so on, eventually I'll see differences, and certainly at atomics until they're different. Okay, but our quantum universe is such that when you get down to that scale of atoms and subatomic particles, those guys are truly identical. And the electron here is identical to an electron anywhere in the universe. Okay, so I can use them interchangeably. Okay, so we don't actually have to beam all of those atoms over. All we have to do is send the information over and then reconstruct Alice's atoms on Mars. Okay? Make sense? All same number of calcium atoms, same number of carbon atoms, we just need the instructions beamed over. Okay? So that's a huge big like savings in effort here, okay? Okay, so next thing, that's the last, okay, we do that thing. Next thing is, will we end up with two copies of Alice? Okay, so here's the thing. We start here, we got Alice here, and we have this magic reassembly machine, which I won't tell you how it works. But here it is, and it's filled with just all the same number of calcium and carbon atoms and stuff as Alice has in it, but just in a completely different form. And what we want to do is we send all this, we measure the information, we beam it over. Isn't that cool? I love this beaming process. So all that information, zeros and ones, you know, computer data comes over, and then we reassemble her in this thing, and so, like, whoa, we have two identical copies of Alice. So you know, and that's going to be bad because then there's going to be the Alice on Earth. Think about this. Alice on Earth, the Alice on Mars having fun with Bob, the Alice on Earth getting jealous, you know, what's my twin Alice doing up there, you know, and all that stuff. It's going to be very bad. Okay, so we can't have that happening. Now, it turns out that this can't actually happen in our universe. Okay, it turns out this was proven, I think in 96 or something, sometime like that. Something called the no cloning theorem. Okay, now, this is not no cloning as in only the It's only the sheep. It's not cloning like that. It's cloning at a much more fundamental level. It's cloning at the level of not DNA and all that stuff. It's cloning at the level of individual subatomic particles. Okay? Turns out that if you have some object, some system, something, okay, it's impossible to make an exact quantum duplicate of that thing. You can't make a copy. Okay? So that's actually good. So what that means is if teleportation is to work at all, and we are to end up with a perfect copy of Alice over here, identical version of Alice here, then it must be true that somehow the original is destroyed. Okay, so that's what our teleportation looks like. Okay, there can be only one true Alice in our universe. Okay. So we're actually teleporting, we're not making a facsimile copy. Okay, so now the next thing is, the question is, how do we actually measure all that quantum information? So before I was just using the word information, and now I'm throwing in there the word quantum information. Because the fact of the matter is, that information is not just about the physical location of this calcium atom with respect to that hydrogen atom. It's not just sort of spatial locations. There's a lot more there. Okay, so we were talking a little bit about like the two particles in the box and the question mark state, right? That's called a superposition state. And atoms and electrons and particles in your body are in complex superpositions. Okay, and so there's a whole lot of very very detailed quantum information in there. Okay? It's not a trivial matter. Okay, so there's tons of information. So the question is, how do we actually measure this information? In Star Trek, it's easy, right? So Gene Roddenberry, he just said, well, make them like, like some kind of scanning thing, and then it's done, right? Okay, well, then it's a bit more tricky than that, okay? So it turns out that in our quantum universe, it's actually not possible. So we can't actually measure the information. Oh, no! What does that mean? That means quantum teleportation can't work, right? We're sunk. Right? Are we all very sad? Sad, right? Okay, well, now it turns out that this was 90, okay, well, let me just say this first. Okay, so it turns out that there are a whole bunch of things going on here. How many of you have heard about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Okay, so some of you have heard about that. And Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek, he's got this thing called the Heisenberg compensators, okay? Which somehow like compensate for this effect, okay? It doesn't actually explain why, if you could explain why. So it turns out that this uncertainty principle limits the amount of information you can extract from a system. It's a fundamental limit on nature, having to do with this quantum nature. Okay, and worse yet, there are certain quantum information which simply can't be measured at all. And that's the superposition stuff I was talking about. Okay, the and states, the head, tail, and tail, head. You can't actually measure that. You can't actually determine that. Okay? Anyways, so whatever, this quantum teleportation is, I mean, that's impossible. Okay, well, it turns out that in 93, Charles Bennett, and collaborators at IBM discovered that quantum entanglement can be used to actually send the information from Earth to Mars without actually measuring it. That's a trick, right? Okay, so how do you do that? Okay, well, it involves this whole teleportation, entanglement thing. Okay, So it turns out quantum teleportation is possible using entanglement. Yay! Okay, so here's how it works. Okay, so this is just actually a warning here. The following is actually science fiction, so it's intended for a mature audience only. So I don't want you walking out of this room thinking, hey, man, like, we're going to be able to find like a quantum teleportation machine like in just like a couple of years that, from there it's going to crank it out, So it turns out that this is actually, well, I'll tell you exactly what has been done with quantum teleportation. But what I'm saying now is we're imagining taking that actual reality and we're scaling it up to a scale that we'll talk about whether or not that's possible. So we're trying to imagine how this whole thing works here. Okay, so here we've got Alice here, and Alice is meditating, getting ready for her trip to Mars. Okay, and so she's sitting inside this laboratory here on the Earth. Okay, and there's a laboratory over on Mars. The timeline quantum teleportation booths. And now what's inside these boots is a bunch of matter. Okay, now this matter here, so it's a bunch of atoms here, calcium, hydrogen, yada yada, or in the better yet, subatomic particles, like electrons, protons, neutrons, okay? Same number as in Ellison's body, okay? And then an identical sort of same number over here, okay? And the dotted line in between that matter shows indicates that particles in here, an electron here, is entangled with particles here, an electron there. Okay, so there's this. So these are all previously we indicated these as question mark states. Okay, so these are in these weird entangled states. Okay, so that's where the entanglement comes in here and plays a crucial property, a crucial role. Okay, next we have next what we do is we're going to do some kind of a scan. Okay, we're not going to actually measure the information because I didn't told you can't do that, but we're still going to do some kind of a scan. Okay, and that scan is the effect of sending information without actually measuring. So anyway, so we're going to do this scan. So here's the scan happening, and you see a bunch of information coming. And this is like a hard drive here, and now it's full of information. So let me just back that up a bit and show you again. So what we're doing here is a scan, and this scan is of both Alice and the matter together. So you're not actually looking at Alice, you're not actually looking at this. You're doing something that's a tricky little thing, and there's some kind of a joint scanning, okay? And in the process of that joint scanning, a whole bunch of things happen. First, your hard drive fills up with tons of information. Second, all of this matter inside this teleporting booth gets entangled. It's all mixed up in some messy sort of fashion, okay? So at the end of the day, what you end up with is a bunch of information in here, and you end up with a mess of entangled atoms here. Okay, no absolute Alice is completely gone. There's no recognizable Alice left. And notice that this matter over here has changed too. Okay, so instantaneously, as you're doing something, it's like the two boxes, Alice and Bob box here. Right, you open the box here, something happens here, something happens here. So instantaneously, something happens to this entangled matter over here. Okay, but what appears here is not quite Alice. Okay? And you don't want to open the box and look inside, because then it'll be like that all the time. It'll be like that all the time, and that'll be that. Because what could be here could be actually look, in general, it'll look very different from Alice. It will, for example, it could be as different as, here's Alice, and what appears there instead is like, a stinking dead fish. Okay? Like, it could be like completely different. Or it could be like, a cow or something. It could be like a very different thing. So you don't want to open the box yet. Okay? Now here's the key thing. The way in which this thing in here differs from the true Alice, okay, those differences are random, but the way that they differ is encoded in this data. This data is real important, okay, so you've got to get this data over here. And you can send data only at a speed of light or less. So although this thing appeared instantly, you got to get this information here, and that's where the limit of the speed of light comes into this teleportation process. Okay, so then we send this, we have another hard disk over here on Mars, and we send the information over using our little radio waves or laser beam or whatever we want to use. Okay, so we get all that information over there, and then what we do is we take Alice over here, and we use this information to set all the dials and settings of our little transforming machine, okay? And then what we do is we let Alice pass through this wonderful little transforming machine and out pops a quantum identical version of Alice on Mars. Okay? So what you end up with is Alice here and a bunch of entangled big mess of atoms over here that doesn't resemble Alice at all. Okay? So that's how the process of teleportation works. Okay? Now, so important points, first of all, is that quantum teleportation does not happen instantly, okay, speed of light or less. Second is that it's the quantum information, it's not the matter itself that is teleported, okay? But in our weird quantum world, that essentially amounts to the same thing. It really is a teleporter, okay, in that sense. So has such a teleportation machine been built? Yeah, okay, but on a very tiny scale. Okay, so in 97, quantum teleportation of a single photon across the lab, and exactly that process that I described was done. This is an absolutely landmark achievement. This is incredible. This is like almost beyond belief that these scientists were able to do this. Okay, so now that you've teleported a single particle, now of course we've talked about rock, we do two particles, we do five particles, how many can we do? There's all kinds of that stuff happening. This was done by two teams basically simultaneously. The Martini's team in Rome and Anton Zeininger's team in Innsbruck. Anton Zeininger is the guy who's been fuzzy here in the back. Alright. So let me just sort of just summarize here, or just words of inspiration here. So our weird quantum world. So basically the quantum universe that we live in is a lot more fascinating, a lot crazier than we could possibly imagine, prior to the invention of quantum mechanics. It's a truly amazing universe that we live in. And it's full of deep mysteries, which is the stuff that people hear at the Fermi Institute is full, right? So the present applications of quantum ideas, I haven't really talked about those, but obviously tons of stuff like computers, lasers, just tons of stuff are applications of quantum mechanics, quantum ideas. But now we are entering a stage where we can begin. Technology is at a stage where we can begin to manipulate atoms manipulate things on a scale of atoms. Okay? A scale of atoms means that the laws of nature that apply are not Newton's laws, but quantum laws. Okay? And so when we build technologies at those scales, it's going to be purely quantum technologies. Okay? They much more so than even the transistor and the laser and all that stuff. I mean, really. Deeply quantum properties of the universe we'll be using, and out will pop, possibly quantum computers. You may have heard about those guys and so on. I have some handouts there that you can look at in more detail. So roughly, it's goodbye information age, hello quantum information age for the 21st century. So let me just sort of end there, and if you have, and let me open up some questions here. So I'm going to turn the lights. They can get really bright. Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions. So, back how many minutes do we have? Oh, wow, we have tons of time. We have 10 minutes. All right. Yeah. Right, I can prove that. That's a good question. So the no cloning theorem. The no cloning theorem basically it has to do with the fact that it's related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So it's related to the idea. Okay, so I'll just write down the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, so it looks like that. What does that mean? The words wasn't over already math on the board. Okay, so it looks something like this, and what it means roughly is this, when we talked about this, right, at the beginning, and we said, how does the electron get here on the screen? Well, there's two ways. We take this path, bounce off this guy, this path, bounce off this guy, and so on. But then we have to somehow assume that the particle was simultaneously in both paths at the same time. Well, that's kind of redundant, but at the same time. Now, roughly speaking, when a particle gets from A to B in our universe across this room, there's a certain sense in which the way that we talk about that is it doesn't go on any different trajectory like this, but it actually exists in a state which is simultaneously all possibilities. Okay, so it starts here and it goes to the moon and it comes back. Starts here and it doesn't move to the moon, goes over here. So the particle, in getting from here to here, nature considers all possible paths they can take. Okay, and somehow it exists. And until you've actually observed it here and here, it exists in this state which is in some sense all of these possibilities. Okay. And so what has been replaced is this definite trajectory, okay? So basically, this Heisenberg uncertainty principle says if you a particle does not possess a definite position, like there it is at that time, and a definite speed. Okay? You can't have that at the same time. And with a particle like this, which is traveling like this, it's like a baseball going across the room, which seems obvious, right? Here's a baseball, it's going across the room. At any instant of time, I take a snapshot, right? And like, there it is. Okay, and it's moving at a certain speed, so it's no problem, right? What's the problem? Well, if you go to atomic scales, This weird kind of thing, what it essentially translates into is that particles don't have, it's that they don't exist simultaneously in position and a speed. Okay, and that's what's causing this fuzziness. Okay? And if you try to measure, the more accurate that you try to pin down the position, okay, then the less accurately you know anything about the momentum. Okay, by trying to, so particles are very claustrophobic. Okay, if I have a particle in a box like this, just one particle, that's it, empty one particle. That particle, you know, okay, whatever, move around. If I now, like, make that box smaller, I'm confining it. I'm making, So when the box is this big, I don't know where the particle is inside the box. It's doing something, some weird point of stuff is going on. It's doing something inside that box. But I know for sure it's inside that box. Okay? So my uncertainty in its position is basically the size of the box. Now I make the box smaller. Okay? So now I make its uncertainty less. I'm more certain about the location of that particle. But by doing so, that particle is claustrophobic, and it starts freaking out. And it starts like, it gets this sort of random, purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy, this energy of motion, just kind of like bouncing around. Okay? And so, and the smaller and smaller I make it, the busier it goes. Okay? So particles have that feel to them. Okay? You can't like pin them down. You can't like pin down the position exactly that. If you do that, then momentum or the velocity, the speed is just like everything. You know, just anything. Okay? So the particles have that kind of feel. You push here and then it goes that way. Or you push there and it goes that way. So you can't pin them down that. So the idea is this is a long-winded answer to your question. So getting back to this question, which was, why can't you quote something? Well, basically, what you want is sort of both. This is loosely speaking. What you want is sort of both, okay? But you can't have both. You can only have one. You can only know the position and then nothing about the speed. Or you can know the speed and nothing about the position, okay? So you can't actually measure the information accurately. Okay, so that's... There are all kinds of different sort of directions to try to answer that, but that's sort of one kind of answer. Kind of answer. Yeah.
So let's go back to the Alice Bob and Stills.
Yeah.
So we did experiment and Alice opened the box of the head and she communicates Bob and says, but I got a head, we didn't have, and he says, I have a tail. So Alice says, Mike heads. And she reads the box, puts the point over, and changes the name into a tail. And then what happens to the ball jet?
Right. Okay. So, entanglement. Yeah, so. So, as it stands, initially you've got the question mark thing. And when Alice, you know, looks inside her box and it's this tail, once that has happened, so you've got the heads, tails, heads, okay? And it's sort of in this combination. So these are sort of two possibilities. And before she looks, it's simultaneous with both. In a certain sense. When she looks, she makes it to choose, and nature chooses this. Then, at that point, they're no longer entangled. Okay? And so, it doesn't matter what Alice does with her point, she can turn this way or that way, she can like, you know, stomp on it, whatever, nothing happens to this, nothing happens here. Okay, so it's not as if entanglement should not be thought of, and okay, now that's proven, I mean, that's right. Okay. Let me just say first this way. Entanglement should not be thought of as I got something over here and I got something over here, and somehow I turn a crank over here and something is happening instantaneously over here. Like I turn a wheel over here and then some other wheel over here turns. Okay, across some vast distance. It's not like that. Okay, it's like I said here. Okay, so once you've done that measurement and they make the choose, then that's it. The connection, sort of broken the connection between them. Okay, but that's not entirely true though. Okay, so we've got researchers at this institute, it's like Anthony Valentini came in the room right now, he's like, you know, be clobbering me on the head. What are you telling them? So he would say, because he's working on some, this is an absolutely deeply mysterious area, nobody really knows what is really going on. Okay? I mean, we have the mathematics to describe what's going on very well. Okay, but we don't know how to interpret that mathematics. Okay, what is it actually saying about reality? So a guy like Anthony Mountain would come in here and he would say, well, you know, what's going on is there is actually sort of some hidden information. So it's a little bit like this. When we talk about, this is going into detail, but here's the thing, the electron gun, right? Okay. And suppose that we had just one atom like this, okay? If I chose this angle to be some angle, like 10.2 degrees, okay, then I would get a heat of the screen at some location, okay? If I chose a slightly different direction, okay, a slightly different angle, then it would hit the screen at a different point. And so there would be a relationship between the angle I choose here and where it hits on the screen, okay? And so the fact that we actually can't predict, so if I knew this information, I could predict where it hits the screen. That's the kind of idea, right? But quantum mechanics apparently doesn't allow us to know this information. It doesn't allow us to sort of fix that information. So we prepare the electron as identically as we can, but we don't seem to have any sort of access to this angle. Whereas Anthony would say something like, "Well, that information actually exists at some kind of, you know, hidden level that we don't have access to. Okay? Some kind of, you know, hidden variable series. Okay? And so you actually do have." And then, through a long chain of argument, there's a certain sense in which entanglement involves a process where, yes, you do turn through here, and then here, and then here turns over here. But those spheres are hidden. Okay, we can't see those. Nature hides those from us. Okay, for some reasons. Okay? And so there are all kinds of different interpretations of the mathematics, and we'll try to go through all those. I just want to give you a feel. The feel that I want to give you is that it's deeply mysterious, and it's this fascinating thing to think about. Okay, and of course, not only is it fascinating, it's really cool in terms of technology. Yeah.
What would happen in that case where Pop and Alice would magically open the box at the same time?
Yeah,
because it seems like, you know, Alice opening it determines sort of, that's, I guess, the collapse of the wave function. It kind of just, you know, becomes deterministic.
Yeah.
But if you could magically have them do that at the same time, I don't know if that's possible.
Yeah. Okay, there's a couple of things to say about that. This whole at the same time. The problem with at the same time, one of the problems is the concept of now was destroyed by Einstein. Okay, so we think of like it's now, right? It's 12 o'clock, it's now, and now means sort of all the stuff that's happening at the same time. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. Because it turns out that this is just a fascinating question. If I snap my finger, right? I'm snapping, here's something happening in a different place in space, and it's happening at the same time for me, right? If I can be coordinatedly enough. Okay, so it's happening at the same time for me. But it turns out that for somebody walking past me like this, they will not see this. They will see this, then this. Okay? Someone walking the other way will see this, then this. Okay, so things that are simultaneous for one person are not simultaneous for another. Okay, and so the very concept, so it's a little bit like, I'll draw that picture. So it, I will. It's so that you can feel it. I don't want you to understand the whole diagram in detail, but it's sort of like this. Here's time, okay, and here is space. Okay, so Newton's view of space, of now, was, so here is me, so I've gone into the time, here is me, and here is you, okay, in the audience. Okay, we're in two different places in space at the same time. Okay? And then as time goes on, the next instant of the time, okay, you know, 2 seconds later, well, there's me, I've moved over there a little bit, and there's you sat in your chair and you moved, you know, so whatever. You know, so stuff like that is happening in space and time. Okay? Well, what Einstein figured out is that space is not really this, like, this surface. Okay? What it is, geometrically, is it's not like that. It's really... it's really a cone. It's more like a... let me draw this. Yes. Okay, so here it is. Here's Newton's idea of space. Well, I tend to be the reality is space is more like this. Space is now ambiguous. What is now? This is the now for one person. This is the now for another person. This is the now for another person. So now is just a relative concept. It has no actual meaning anymore. So the idea of Alice came back.
That's more maybe the message.
So I don't know how that comes about. So he got Alice involved and the very concept of doing then opening the box at the same time and calling them. That's one thing to say. Second thing to say is it's not as if Alice and Bob actually suppose that. Okay, let's do it this way. Suppose that Alice and Bob have a whole bunch of boxes, okay? And they're all entangled. They're all like entangled pairs here, this way. Okay? And so what they do is they go through sort of a sequence. Okay? So Alice opens the first box. Oh yeah, and then So just from let me say it this way. Forget about Bob entirely. Let's just focus on Alice. Alice opens this box and purely at random it turns out to be a head. Okay, so it's the next box. Purely at random. Oh look, it's a head. And it's a tail. And it's a head. And it's a tail. Okay. So she sees this kind of combination. Okay? Now Bob. Okay, whether he's opening the box at the same time, or not quite at the same time, or it's completely irrelevant. Okay? He opens his boxes, and he finds this particular thing. This seems to be a completely random thing. He finds tails and tails and heads and tails and heads. Okay? Now, so he has a whole sort of kind of like data sheet. Okay? So he writes all these symbols down on a sheet of paper. Okay? And then he's here on the Earth, and travels up to Alpha Centauri, and shows them to Alice, and they say, there's a perfect correlation between these things. Okay? But the issue of same time or not is just, so what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that there will be this correlation between these guys, but it doesn't really depend upon when you measure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have they been able to show that correlation experimentally?
Yeah. So I have for you this article here, which I will stick at the end here. This is a wonderful article, and it addresses exactly the question I'm asking. This is and I photocopied it. Despite all breaking all possible copyright laws, I'm sure. So if anyone asks where you got this, you didn't get it from me. so we actually have to quit. So let me just say this article addresses your question. And so basically speaking, what people did, and this was a hugely influential and important experiment done in the 1980s, by the way, and what he showed roughly at the end of the day, what it shows is that Einstein's picture of the universe. Einstein always, that he had some troubles with quantum mechanics. There were some problems that he believed that it had, and there was a certain way in which he saw the universe being. Okay, and it turns out that these experiments basically ruled out that way of thinking of the universe. Okay, and it's an absolutely fascinating set of experiments. And basically what they've left us with is the fact that there are two sort of cherished sort of beliefs or ways of thinking about the universe that we kind of like. We have to throw out one of them. I don't quite know which. And one of those is sort of this things cannot come fast into your life, that's kind of like one thing. Now maybe there is something that is actually going on a hidden scale, fast into your life. Or we have to give up the idea that what's inside those boxes isn't in a definite state at all times. We have to really accept the idea that inside that box is something that isn't in a definite state. It's really in an indefinite thing. Okay, this article is a fantastic article. I recommend you read this. And so there's a copy of it here, and there's also a copy of selected articles and websites on quantum mechanics. So these are some really good references here if you want to look up and read about some more stuff. At the very end, there is something on quantum technologies here. So there's a quantum computing, quantum teleportation website, and so on. There's all kinds of fun stuff to look at. So. So, and you can also pick up one of these things, which is sort of a brief little blurb on the various scientific outreach programs that's coming up here from the Institute. Well, thanks a lot for your questions. This was fun. And